Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 324.
This week on the podcast, California State Senate candidate Kip Mueller joins us to talk about how you, a regular person, could start a campaign for office.
And either Biden, Warren, or Sanders are winning the Democratic race by either a little or a lot, according to various numbers.
Biden, much like Trump, is fine with being considered a war hero for stories of his own invention.
And guys, could we just win the Senate?
Plus, Bernie is going to cancel all medical debt.
Which we'll all have soon enough, since mass shootings are happening every second.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
So, we've been promising you a guest for a while now.
yes.
Kip did come on this week. We're going to be talking to him a little bit later in the podcast after we just go over some of the major electoral news stories of the week.
Yep.
So make sure you listen through for that. But the exciting news of this week was really an exciting story about polling.
Yes.
You know how we love polling.
We love polling.
There's some contrasting polling going on the Democratic side.
And we don't love it because we put any stock in it, necessarily.
Of course not. We've learned
our lesson. Right. We've been doing this. This is our 324th podcast. We know that polling numbers are garbage.
That's right.
Yeah. But much like jobs numbers.
Exactly. But we do enjoy finding a poll that confirms something we've always suspected and then really running with it, even though mathematically it may not make sense.
Well, and you can learn things from polls, especially if there are multiple ones that sort of like say a similar thing. Now, the one that we're talking about is the most recent Monmouth poll, and it showed something very dramatic, but we had been seeing in other polls, though.
Yes.
So it's not...
Right, we're seeing extreme version of this in other polls.
The numbers are still probably outliers.
Right.
But basically what this poll had was that Sanders and Warren were tied at 20% and Biden was a point behind at 19%, obviously within the margin of error. And then Kamala Harris was in fourth place at 8%.
So here's one thing that's true about this poll. Like in all polls, Sanders, Warren, and Biden are the only double-digit candidates at the moment. So, and this same poll had showed numbers that were more reflective of larger polling averages just last month, just a couple months ago. So in June, Sanders was down 6 at 14, Warren was down 5 at 15, and Biden was up 13. So Biden was at 32 in this same poll, which is pretty on track for what the larger polling averages have been showing.
Right. And so that's what I was telling people too, because like there was a lot of, you know, immediate sort of like discounting of this poll. And I was just sort of like, well, you know, maybe this poll isn't it. Like, I don't know. I'm not here to be the poll. I'm not going to pretend like I'm Nate Silver because he doesn't even get it right a lot of the time anyway. But he was one of the people who was just sort of like, this poll is garbage. But it's like, well, maybe not though, because it at least showed similar trends that so many of the other polls have been showing, which is Warren way up, Bernie actually recovering a little bit too after people had sort of written him off, and Biden coming back to the field. We've been seeing that. Now, a lot of other polls have him still ahead by 9, 12, even 15 points, but we have seen the closing of the gap and certainly Warren rising out of single digits into being a strong second or sometimes third.
Exactly. And this poll shows that, and also in general was kind of good press for Warren anyway, because the real thing that I think everyone took away that made them panic about it was, oh my God, Warren's surging.
Yes.
You know, we're used to seeing Sanders go up and down in the polls a bit. He's
Harris has gone up and down in the polls a bit.
Harris
too.
Has gone
she
up and down in the
to
polls.
Have flatlined maybe just a little bit. Buttigieg is sort of now in the sort of like low-ish single digits.
Right.
Seems to be.
Which we told you would happen. but the Warren sort of slow surge has been the story this whole time. And this, as much as it made everyone panic and then doubt polls, told that story in a really dramatic fashion, got everyone talking about it. So now everyone realizes that Warren
that
is surging.
She's in the game.
Right. So that was exciting. And the poll also showed something else that I think is interesting, which is Biden slipping with moderate and conservative Democrats. So these are Democrats that self-identify as either moderate or conservative. And that's a concerning trend for him because that's really his base.
Yeah,
so he's been slipping with everyone, but he's slipping in much larger numbers with his own base.
Yeah. Well, and one thing that I think has caused that, and you've seen this in other polls too, is that you continue to see her electability numbers go up.
Yes.
Amazing how that
happens.
Because that has always been, you see and you hear all of these reports about you know, a large majority of people who are like, well, I would like to vote for her if.
Right.
Or, you know, if only we lived in a world where she could win. And I feel like that perception is changing a little bit. And that, I think, is probably what is causing people to leave from him. Because my guess is that they're going to her. I can't believe that they're going anywhere else. They're,
Well, where would, I mean, the numbers.
Where else would they go? The numbers indicate that that is where they went.
The same, right. I think also electability is almost exclusively predicated on name recognition.
Well, right.
In these early days.
Yes.
And so the fact that she is just sort of slowly becoming more familiar to people.
Yeah.
Gives her an air of electability because you're much more likely to believe someone's electable once you've heard of them.
Yes.
And so I think that's part of what we're seeing here is her electability numbers are rising inevitably because people are, because of things like this where people are like, oh my God, did you see where Liz Warren was in that poll?
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, Liz Warren, a person I've heard
right,
of.
She's great.
Yeah, I love her. And then they say that to a friend and the friend is like, me too. And then they're like, wait a minute, did we both love Liz Warren this whole time? Like, I feel like that has been happening a little bit.
Right, I thought I was a Biden supporter. Exactly. Just because I knew that he was the vice president once.
Right, exactly. I feel like a lot of the time, these like electability numbers are largely influenced by people having the ability to say, did you see Liz Warren in that poll? And then their friend going, yeah, I like her.
Yeah.
And then being like, wait a minute.
Right. She could be the president.
I like her too. I didn't know I could support her.
Right.
I didn't know we liked her. I didn't know we all liked her.
Yeah.
Now we know.
Yeah.
We also have the 10 candidates set for the Democratic debate.
Right.
That's right. 10.
Speaking of polls. Yes. Speaking of it's going to be 10. And it was a real nail biter there too, because Tom Steyer had 3 polls. Like I think when we did this podcast last week,
he had
3
now
polls.
Now he's mad.
And you needed 4.
At the criteria. Did you see that today?
Yeah. Well, so was Tulsi Gabbard, I think, too.
Because, the two of them were almost okay with the criteria until they weren't.
Well, and you know what? I'm of 2 minds about this, basically, because, you know, they have known what the criteria was for a long time, and they know what polls have been allowed. But I am sort of with them in sort of their questioning of what polls are allowed.
Yeah.
Because Tulsi Gabbard's campaign released some statement listing, you know, like 20-some odd polls where she's at 2%. Now, are some of them like cuckoo bananas polls that she might have been like the, you know, Daily Kos, like, you know, snap poll where you could vote online? Like, probably so. But also, you know, YouGov has been doing early state polls for CBS. Those are counting. YouGov is doing national polls for The Economist. Those aren't counting.
Right.
So there is sort of, I think, a question of, like, why is it that who decided which polls were the ones that we were going to use?
I'll tell you who they are.
Right, the DNC. And granted, they did release them a long time ago. They have not changed those. So, you know,
they are also people who are trying to get the field down.
Sure.
They're not people who are trying to make it easier for people to get into these debates.
Now, I'm personally glad that neither of those two made it, not because I dislike them, although I do sort of dislike them. But I'm glad just because an 11th person would have gone back to making this a two-night affair.
That's right. That would have been an awkward situation because then not only would we have had the field split into 2 debates that were very small.
Right. You could have had, like, Joe Biden with only Marianne Williamson and Tom Steyer and
which is what we know would have happened.
Probably.
Because that's what happens every time.
Yeah.
So here are the 10. Brent could do them off the top of his head, which was so impressed by.
I went to go list them and I didn't ever even stop to be like, oh, who's the 10th one? I just wrote them all down.
I would have had to stop over at least 3 of these people.
I felt really great about it, actually.
I mean, I would have been stopping after the first 5 to be like, I don't think O'Rourke is in that field. Is he? I would have doubted myself.
Yeah,
I'm impressed by your.
Yeah. It's Biden, Sanders, Warren, Harris, Buttigieg, Castro, O'Rourke, Klobuchar, Yang, and Booker.
I'll tell you who would have tripped me up.
I know.
Yang, because I would have forgotten because he's just like a different genre of candidate.
Well, you see which name I put last.
Yeah, Booker.
That's the one that it came to me last.
Right.
It came to me quickly,
but it was the one
that really almost got me.
Yeah. O'Rourke, I would have been like, I know, like it's because I'm not personally considering him a real candidate that I can't, like, keep track of the fact that he, like, clearly has funders and he's polling fine-ish for this field. But, like, I wouldn't have been – I just couldn't in my head I can't in my head keep his name with the names.
Sure, yeah.
So I have that. You know, the rest of them I probably would have gotten. And even Yang, maybe because it was such a big deal that he got in.
Yeah.
Because he's beat out all the other fringe candidates.
Oh, totally.
I mean,
yeah.
Think about who's gone here. You know, we have Tulsi Gabbard is, by some measures, an almost legitimate candidate. She's gone.
Right.
You know, he's beaten out members of Congress. He's beaten out members of the Senate. Like, this...
Right.
This
beat out Kirsten Gillibrand,
who has dropped out.
Who's out.
And so he's not just beating out the sort of fringe contingent. He's beating out, like, real people.
Yeah, real people.
So that's quite a... And Tom Steyer, I don't know what he thought he was up to. First of all, where is he fundraising from? We've said it before, and I refuse to stop saying it.
You know, I agree. We talked about this, I think, at one point. I mean, he bought himself enough dollar donations is pretty much what he did.
Yeah.
I mean, he has spent millions and millions and millions of dollars and basically has spent all of it on digital advertising to try and get people to give
digital
him
advertising,
1 cent.
The man has spent millions of dollars on being on our TV screen since the dawn of time every day to personally tell us Trump is terrible.
Right.
No reason. Just out here reminding you as a billionaire that everyone hates Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Like that. So I'm not surprised to hear that he didn't make it.
Yeah.
And I'm actually kind of happy because he doesn't deserve to be up there.
I fear that
Screw
he's going to.
He's going to get up. I know.
I think he'll get that 2%. Although, I don't know. Here's the thing is that, you know, they now have a long time to the next debate. I think it's like toward the end of October or something.
Right.
I think they just recently said it. I don't know when the date is. This third one is the September 12th. So it's coming up, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, it seems to me like maybe he could get another poll with 2%, but also not being on the next debate stage.
Yeah, it might make it hard.
I think makes it harder for the people who aren't on the next debate stage, because why would you tell a pollster that you're going to vote for Tulsi Gabbard if it now starts to appear that
she's not
an actual
candidate?
Yeah. Right.
No, I think that is going to... They're going to have to really get these in the next 2 weeks in order to...
I think so, too.
Get
in.
But, so in any case, that...
Steyer only needs one more, Gabbard needs two more, and Williamson really is the next closest.
Yeah, that's right. So if you want to know what's become of Tim Ryan, Michael Bennett, Joe Sestak, we're about to start our candidate profile series, and we're going to start with them because we know they're the most likely to drop out. And listen, it is going to be important to know how the campaign goes for some of the bigger names. You're going to want to, when we do the Liz Warren bio, you're going to want to hear how her campaign has gone.
Yeah.
These guys, there's not going to be much change. So we're going to be starting releasing those on Monday, so stay tuned for that. The first one we're releasing is Tim Ryan, because we have devoted a lot of time to talking about how angry his face makes us.
Right.
And so we wanted to let you know that we have done the work to find out
what
his deal
is.
We get him. And we're still mad about it. In any case, as we said, Gillibrand is the first high-profile exit of the most recent exiting era.
Yeah.
I think, because she... Unlike some of these other guys who actually are fringe candidates, you know, John Delaney's.
Sure.
She expected to actually poll and place well, and it has been much harder for her than she expected. I think, I'm sure she didn't expect, you know, she's been plotting to run for president for years. We've been talking about this for years. But I don't think she expected the field to be this deep. I don't think that she expected to have this Franken thing bite her back forever, even in the Me Too era. I mean, that's what's so kind of sad about that whole situation is she really was sort of on trend for a moment for an issue that is buzzy, but she just sort of like didn't ever capture it right.
Yeah.
And you know,
she overplayed her hand.
She overplayed her hand a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, sorry to see her go, because it would have, she's someone who
was bringing
something to the race.
I agree. She was one of the people who I was not going to probably vote for, or definitely not going to vote for in the primary, but enjoyed having her there. Leading up to the first debate where she was barely didn't get her 65,000, I gave her a couple bucks just because I was like, she's a person
who should be
around.
Yeah.
Right.
No. And so it's too bad that she, you know, it's too bad we still have all these generic white men in the race, but like she's out. But it is, we're reaching a moment where legitimate candidates who aren't quite on the cusp are going to start bolting, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Meanwhile, another gaffe fest for Biden.
This one's quality.
Oh my God. You guys, this is the most amazing story of the week by far. So imagine this. You're at a town hall in New Hampshire, like you probably always are in New Hampshire.
Sure.
There's like,
you might think you're in Vermont, but you're actually in New Hampshire.
But you see all the fireworks around. You see that people rolled up on motorcycles without helmets.
Sure.
And you're like, oh, fuck, yes, we are in New Hampshire. You see that the state is not properly zoned for anything.
There's not street signs anywhere.
Right,
there's,
exactly. You're lost. You're in New Hampshire because you couldn't get out. And you wind up at a college, you know, assembly hall.
Sure.
With 400 of your neighbors.
Sure.
To see the one and only Joe Biden speak.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And he tells this dramatic story.
Oh, my God.
About a four-star general.
Stemwinder.
Asks him, back when he's the vice president, to travel to the Konar province of Afghanistan, which is very dangerous, to give a silver star to a Navy captain, an older guy, who somehow, despite his age, rappelled down a 60-foot ravine under fire, retrieved the body of a fallen American soldier, and carried him out on his back.
Well, that is a good story.
That's right.
It's a movie, actually, that's what it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Biden is told this is a risky trip. He is advised against taking this trip, but he doesn't care.
No.
He's going.
He's brave.
And then he gets there,
yeah,
and the soldier doesn't even want the medal. He
says,
sir, I don't want the damn thing. Don't pin it on me, sir. Please, sir, do not do that. He died. He died. And then at the very end, as the crowd in silence stares wistfully at Biden, he says, this is the God's truth. My word as a Biden.
My word as a Biden.
Here's the problem.
Yeah.
Almost no detail of that story is true.
Yeah, he made that story up.
The time period is wrong. The location is wrong. The heroic act is different than what the true version of
the
events
type of
was.
Medal is wrong.
The type of medal is wrong. The military branch and rank is wrong.
Yep.
The recipient is wrong.
As well as his own role in the ceremony.
Right.
Biden's, also wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So according to interviews that the Washington Post did with people who would have had the reason to know about this event.
Yeah.
It's an amalgam of... I said amalgam.
Amalgam, sure. It's an amalgamation.
It's an amalgamation. It's an amalgam of a few different stories.
Sure.
One in which Biden did visit the Konar province, but in 2008 as a senator.
Right.
And that was a dangerous province.
Right. The truthiness stops there, basically.
Basically. This service member who performed this celebrated rescue that Biden references did exist, but he was not in the Navy. He was an Army specialist. He was 20 years old. Right. And so he was not a captain.
Right.
The soldier... never got a silver star.
Oh, no.
Or any other medal pinned on him by Biden because
or
he got the Medal of Honor from Obama 6 years after Biden's visit to the Konar province. And then, so in 2011, Biden did pin a medal on to a soldier.
But that was
a soldier, a soldier who didn't believe he deserved the award.
Mm-hmm.
But that was Army Staff Sergeant Chad Workman. And it was not for the feat that was described in Biden's story. And it's interesting because he's been trying to build his like brand on these war stories for a while. So he tells this story a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Like Trump, Biden never served in the military.
Right.
He is trying to create this sort of sense that he is a military adjacent person.
Right.
Because his son, Bo, who's the one who died of a brain cancer. Back in 2015, did deploy to Iraq, but is an Army lawyer.
Yeah.
In 2008.
Yeah.
So his son was in the military.
Yes.
And Biden sort of places himself in a lot of these stories as military adjacent.
Yes.
But fails to mention that he himself is not a veteran.
Right.
And also, just as a reminder to everyone, before we tell you what stories this was an amalgam of, in 1987, Biden was also running in a presidential race.
Yeah.
And he had to drop out.
Yes.
And the reason he had to drop out was charges that he had plagiarized the speeches of a British politician and a few other people.
That's
so
right.
Biden has a long and storied history of making shit up and taking other people's stories.
Right.
This story in particular has been slowly spinning out of control for a while, apparently. So his first public recounting of it was right after his trip to Konar in 2008. It was mostly a true account of what happened.
Right.
And then he kind of stopped telling the story for a while until around 2014 when... he gave the bronze star to somebody who made that heroic rescue. So the guy didn't get a silver star, but he did give a bronze star to somebody.
Yes.
Then in 2016, he was at a World War II ceremony in Australia. And in that version, the young soldier who actually made the heroic rescue got replaced by this older Navy captain who climbed down.
Climbed
and this was a 200-foot ravine.
200-foot, and he climbed.
And he climbed.
He didn't rappel.
Right. Yeah, he climbed down a much larger ravine in that story.
Yeah.
Then months later, the story gets more harrowing for Biden.
Right.
So he's at an October rally for Hillary Clinton, and the setting shifts from Afghanistan to Iraq.
Also, don't be talking about Afghanistan or Iraq at a Hillary Clinton rally, by the way. You're on the wrong subject.
It's like, worst idea ever. And then, instead of rappelling down a ravine, an army captain had pulled a dead soldier out of a burning Humvee in that story. And then, by the way, the Pentagon has no record of an army captain receiving a silver star in Iraq during that time period at all. But okay. 3 weeks later, he's stumping for Jason Kander and tells the story in both the Iraq and Afghanistan versions, gets them back, gets them all in a single speech.
Oh, my.
First, it was a Navy captain who rappelled down the ravine in Konar, and then he sagged into the Army officer who got the burning Humvee person from Iraq.
Sure. Okay.
So then he kind of got, the stories became two stories that were, told together.
Told together, right.
And then on Friday in New Hampshire, it became one master story.
Right.
That included no true facts. And yet, somehow, ended with him saying it was his word as a Biden. Isn't this exactly what took down Brian Williams? And Brian Williams was not running for president, even.
Right. I know.
He was just a paid newsreader. Like,
yeah.
Brian Williams is a reporter.
Had some, like,
and
harrowing
anchor.
Act, like, in a crashed helicopter or something,
yes, the helicopter.
Right?
That, yeah, right? It was in a helicopter, and the helicopter crashed, and it turned out he was in a helicopter and a helicopter crashed, but it wasn't the same helicopter or something like that. So this story, the fact, I mean, it's such a detailed story.
I know.
And he really ramps up the drama in it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The fact, like,
yeah, he tells a good story.
He's a good storyteller. That's what makes him, I mean, he's a politician. That's he's a charming guy who can tell a story. That's right. What being a politician is. And he tells this story in a really, like, pseudo-dramatic.
Sure. Oh, yeah, dramatic, very earnest, I'm sure.
Earnest,
like,
fashion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that he's trying to make himself into, like, the tough guy who
right, that he
can
went
take
in
down
there
Trump because he went into the Konar province of Afghanistan and did something that wasn't even true is, like, of all the things.
Oh, man.
And places and people.
What a mess.
None of which were true in this story.
But rest assured, he's not brain damaged.
No, of course not. As his campaign has assured us, that's not the issue at all. Apparently, the issue is just that he has no care for details, which is a quality you definitely want in a president. But it has led to a little discussion about whether truth matters anymore. It's gotten very meta on interwebs.
Oh, no.
Because now it's sort of like, well,
he's telling an alternative story.
He's telling an alternative story. And Donald Trump does that all the time.
Yeah, oh,
Donald
sure.
Trump will put himself in a war zone.
I mean, Donald Trump just tried to give himself the Medal of
Honor. Exactly.
So
and Donald Trump also, as you recall, personally cleaned up Ground Zero. So, I mean,
that's right.
Donald Trump has already done something like this.
Yeah.
But I would argue that we don't need to lower our standards to that extent in order to have a human be the president. It doesn't feel like just because Trump is doing it, we should let Biden do it.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like we should let Trump do it.
I agree.
We shouldn't let anyone do it, but we certainly shouldn't let two people do it.
Yeah.
If we're going to let anyone do it, let it only be one person. And let's let that person not come back to being the president. In any case.
Yeah.
So we also told you on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, I think on our Iowa podcast,
about our
excitement about a proposed plan in Iowa that would allow for virtual caucusing.
Right.
Because one of the downsides of caucusing, I say as a person who's never caucused, is that you got to show up and caucus.
Right. And it's in the evening. You can't just go vote in the morning before you go to work.
Right.
You have to go at the time. They drag on for hours sometimes, and they definitely will this time because
there's 36
candidates. And so, you know, it's hard. It's a hard process.
Yeah.
And so in an attempt to sort of like broaden the people who can participate in this, the DNC after 2016 basically gave the early caucus states a directive that they needed to make them more open to people.
And there's only two early caucus states, so it feels like we should have been able to work this out.
Right. So it's really only Iowa and Nevada who this affects specifically right now. And so both of those states were coming up with a system, like a virtual system that was basically telephone-based, where instead, and it was going to be like in the 3 days leading up to, at least in Iowa, I'm not sure if that's how many days it was in Nevada, but you could basically like call in and partake in the caucuses before the actual caucus night. So it was basically like early voting.
Yeah.
So the states had to release their plans, and the DNC just this week said that they were not going to allow those plans.
Yeah.
So both of those states now are like, well, shit, what are we supposed to do?
Right, they've all been talking about it, too.
They've all been talking about it. Yeah, some of them released their plans quite a while ago.
Yeah.
And it seems a little shady on the DNC's part, because they told these states that they had to do it. The states worked really hard at it. And the reason that they're saying is because they're saying that there's security issues. And the reason that they're saying security issues is because there were some security experts from the DNC who managed to hack into a conference call involving the community and both Nevada and Iowa parties.
Involving the committee.
The committee, sorry, yeah. Yes. The DNC committee and the Nevada and Iowa state parties when they were talking about this.
Right.
So that raised questions about security because they were able to hack into this phone call. But here's the thing. The officials in Iowa who were working on this plan were like, the system that we were using for this conference call to talk about this, which was just a conference call where right. we were chatting, like you would call into,
like
any time
that you might call into a conference call if you're a person who has a place of business.
Right. Was not the same system that they're planning to use for these phone calls
right.
for
so
the virtual caucus.
So basically, they rejected it on the basis that phones in general can be hacked at times by people using phone systems.
Correct.
Right. Which doesn't
but not
seem
the actual system that Iowa was planning to use for the virtual caucus.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Just systems in general.
Right.
But you as a person can...
Hi, we just joined this phone call, so you can
so
no
you
longer have a virtual
so people
caucus.
People can't vote in this state.
Right. Right. That's basically what happens.
Yeah. They hacked into a phone conference call. And I have accidentally gotten on the wrong conference call before.
All the time.
I mean, that's a problem with the... Because the codes are too long.
The codes are too long, and also...
You have to remember
like,
the number and the code.
And ours at the office, you know, you can book them for 30-minute increments, but then the number also still works. So if you run over 15 minutes and there's another conference call, a new one just... starts, so all of a sudden you call in and you're on the right. You're
right,
on
a different, conference
the,
call.
Ending the previous conference call. It's not a perfect system, no. So I get it. Right. It's not hard to hack into one of those.
No. No, it's so not hard that it seems like an entire state's new voting plan shouldn't be thrown out on the basis of it.
Well, that's what you would think.
But here we are.
Here we are.
So in any case, no one's really sure what's going to happen now.
Yeah.
Because we're not really sure how these caucuses are going to move forward. These accessibility requirements were imposed by the DNC.
Right. So basically, they would either... They have a couple choices. They would basically have to apply for a waiver
right.
to get out of those requirements that the DNC set. But both Iowa and Nevada seem like they're sort of going to try and figure out
some
sort of
way... Well, people are excited about these systems.
Well, right.
I mean,
I know.
Wouldn't it be great if a lot of people could vote in the caucus?
It would be. Yes.
I mean, you would think.
Yeah.
It might be a thing that's great.
Yeah. Selfishly, I feel like the caucuses go better for progressives
if nobody
when
shows
less
up.
People
right.
can go. So there is that. But as a person who is always telling people to vote whenever they can.
Right. It feels.
It seems like you should be participating in the caucuses if you can.
That's right.
So I get it.
Yeah. Like, well, and also in a year like this.
Well, right.
It may not hold true that just because it's opened up.
100%.
You know,
and also there's reasons where it would be better for progressives because people could call into. You know, you could, a lot of college students end up not doing it because they're not registered
right.
in the place where they are living while they're at school and
totally.
They can't necessarily go home. And it's also in February. So sometimes you can't even like physically, like you certainly wouldn't be able to, there might be a snowstorm
right,
causing
you
to not drive 2 hours to go back home to your caucus.
Yeah.
Or even leave your house for that matter at all. So the idea of being able to do it over the phone is sort of,
appealing.
You know, appealing to people. So you would think that more young people would partake of that. Option. So I think that you're right. This sort of like allowed for sort of like different people to be voting
right.
in the caucus. I think it also allows for a lot of old people to be voting
right.
in the caucus
right.
too. but regardless, you still want
well,
as many people in the process.
Vote.
All these people should get to vote. So and that is always one of the problems with the caucus
system. Yeah.
System. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It requires you to show up.
Right. And they of course. There were some reports of people in New Hampshire getting antsy about it, too, because I think that there were a lot of people who were just sort of, like, thinking that what Iowa was going to do was just declare that they were going to have a primary.
Right. And then New Hampshire was like, we're the first primary.
Right,
how dare you?
Right. So there's all of
there's
this
There's industries
sort of like
around
first
all of these
and,
things.
Right. And then, of course, people in Iowa are like, well, we have to do this. I think, like, the first statement that they, like, came out with, like, the Iowa Democratic Party was like, you know— Don't worry, on February 3rd, there will be a caucus, you know, because I think,
right,
like, there's just so much pride and, like, I think people thought that it might throw the whole thing in flux, and
right.
I think it still kind of is, but they're basically sort of, like, reassuring everyone,
like
don't worry, the first in the nation caucus is going to happen.
Right.
Like,
somehow.
Somehow.
Right.
Right.
You'll either vote in it or you won't.
Yeah. But it does seem like there's, like, some weird shadiness going on there,
yeah.
and I can't necessarily put my finger on it, but it's odd.
Yeah. Well, I think in a year where the DNC itself has so little control over what's going on, that they would ask for accessibility and then be like, wait a minute.
Well, right.
Is suspicious to me just because, you know, they meddled in ways in the last
right.
cycle, but the last cycle was a much simpler cycle
right.
for them.
Well, that's what I was going to say. And if a lot of these candidates stay in until Iowa, which I don't think a lot of them will, but I think there's still going to be a high number of
yeah.
them, caucus night is going to be a shit show.
Oh, yeah.
So
and
I
you
think
know what, guys, stay in. Let's live a little.
Yeah, call.
Like, let's, you know, let's Make it happen. Like, first of all, every candidate, just commit to being there. You know?
Sure.
Stay in the race.
Yeah.
Every person, commit to showing up.
Yeah.
I want as much of a shit show as possible to occur in the caucuses.
Yeah.
It feels right.
Yeah.
It does. Meanwhile, wouldn't you know it, once you start running candidates for seats in places, and we're going to talk a little bit about this with Kip, actually, later on in the podcast. But once you start running people for seats in places, seats become winnable that weren't previously winnable before no one was running them.
Right.
And that is what we're seeing right now in the Senate, because suddenly this week all these articles came out that were like, oh my God, you guys, the Senate is winnable.
Yes.
And you know what? It always has been.
Right.
What it took was running candidates for the Senate that were real candidates.
Yep.
You know, not running some hack, boring candidate who doesn't have any reason to think they can win, but is their father is the most important businessman in the state.
Right.
Or whatever.
Right.
Running candidates who want to win for Senate.
Yeah, there was a big article in the New York Times about it. There was also an article in The Hill about it. And basically, the Republicans are worried about this across the board, because they're worried about it with House districts, and they're also worrying about how it's going to affect, you know, what states Trump is able to, or is going to be
able to win.
Because
they're losing some interesting voters.
Right, exactly.
And by interesting, it means fairly obvious.
Right,
I mean, I know.
A huge part of what happened in 2018, and so I would, you know, we would sort of say that more things than this happened in 2018 to sort of, you know, allow for us to take back the House. But one of the things that definitely did happen was that there were a lot of suburban women voters who were uncomfortable voting with Trump, who either did not vote or voted for a Democrat.
Yeah.
And there's some current concern within the GOP that is a trend that is going to continue into 2020.
I don't know why it would.
And potentially continue on. I mean, I don't know why. Like, once, it seems to me like once we get these voters, we should be able to then have them.
Yes, agreed. Yeah, I feel...
Especially when Trump is on the ballot again.
I was going to say, I feel like once you are... You know, it's one thing if you are sort of, the Republican Party has always relied on some misogyny, and their policy has always been fairly misogynistic. But it's another thing to be like, oh, they're talking about me this way.
Yes.
I don't belong here.
Right.
Like, I don't see how then they can think they're going to keep these voters.
Yeah. But that is specifically causing some issues in some key states that are already sort of, we're going to be toss-ups, I think. Anyway, regardless of knowing, even if we didn't know what had happened in 2018, I think people were looking at a 2020 map and being like, oh, well, let's maybe win Colorado.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and now we can.
And now
because
we
finally
can.
Got Hickenlooper Looper out of the presidential race, and he is polling way ahead of his opponent, who is the incumbent in that race.
Yeah. Same with Arizona. We already won a Senate seat in Arizona.
Exactly.
Why can't we win the other
one? Why wouldn't we? It's a statewide race.
Right.
North Carolina is
always up
in
the
North Carolina has been in the discussion, I think, because they have had some voter fraud issues there. They've been in,
There's a special election coming up. That we should be keeping our eye on.
Well, and that a friend of mine just did a really great podcast about for Crooked Media. So look up that as well. The sort of trend in North Carolina is in part, I think, being driven by the fact that people have been really paying attention to what's been going on in North Carolina because the results of their federal elections have been so anti-democratic.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a heavily gerrymandered state that I think for a statewide seat, there's going to be some like real interest in people turning out. And then in Maine because
also,
Susan Collins is ruining it.
Kavanaugh.
Yeah. She's ruining stuff.
Yeah. And I think that, but to your point about running candidates in those places, John Hickenlooper aside, there were already a lot of good candidates running in Colorado, and actually the party came in and endorsed Hickenlooper the day after he announced, and I think like a bunch of those candidates like wrote a letter together to the party
to
and
be
was
like,
just
screw
like
you.
What like we've been at this for months, we've been fundraising, some of us are like actual people who are like in the state house here, like we could win this race, like it's not the one boring white guy just who sort of like comes in and is going to be the savior for everyone. You know, I do think that he probably does stand a good chance there because he has been elected statewide, so I get it, but like that was sort of a little bit shady there.
Well,
but you know,
it's a famous
but he's
DNC
a, right I was gonna say it is but you know, he's whether we like him or not, he's a good candidate in the state. I think the leader of the state assembly in Maine is running against Susan Collins.
And
like,
they've been fundraising for that seat for a while.
Right, she's a good candidate. Mark Kelly is running in Arizona.
And he's think, polling just slightly in the lead for the first time recently. So
yeah, and I'm not totally sure who's running in North Carolina.
Yeah,
but
I'm not
I
sure
mean,
what the
you know, it seems like if there's a good... So it's like, it's... it goes beyond just being like, oh, that's a winnable state. It's like, do we have somebody who can actually win an election here? Do we have a serious person running it?
Right.
And in most of these cases, we do.
There's other opportunities outside of the traditional toss-up states, which is unusual. Yeah,
for sure. Because I think, you know, Joni Ernst is up for re-election here, and there are a lot of good candidates running for her. That's another one that the DNC has already endorsed in. But somebody new just recently announced this week, who's like a 3-star Navy general. Who is going to be, there's going to be a good Democratic, somebody good is going to come out of that primary to run against Joni Ernst.
Right.
And that, I think, is going to be probably a toss-up state. It did go for Trump, but I mean,
we flipped most of the House districts.
There's only one Republican-held House district now.
And district the opponent who ran against Steve King, J.D. Schotin, is running again, and that seat might flip.
Yeah.
And there's also that Mitch McConnell race.
Right, and Amy McGrath is running there. And she's a serious candidate, and she's been fundraising business.
That's a seat that people will have their eye on,
we are not so far removed from a Democratic governor in Kentucky.
Right, no, exactly.
I mean, before Matt Bevin won there, he won against a Democrat.
Exactly.
I mean, so that is not... And I think
people think.
And I think people are sort of like mostly fed up with like Mitch McConnell and his shit.
I would hope
I mean.
I mean, he's literally, it's not even about whether or not you're Republican or Democrat. He's about inaction. You know, that's where you start to get into trouble as a politician, I think. It's not, if you're a fringe right-wing person, then fine. If you are delivering for your constituents, then great.
Well, right.
I think, and this is something that the Democrats fall into a lot, where they moderate themselves to the extent that they no longer are actually proposing anything.
Right.
He's basically not doing anything.
Well, that's the thing. I think there are a lot of people on the far right who get angry, who don't necessarily want the government to be passing laws every day because they prefer small government.
Right.
But they also want the government to be working better.
Right. No, exactly.
So you hear a lot of complaints about that. Like, it's no, you know, if all of the people in Kentucky who say that the government isn't working looked in front of their faces
inward,
then they would, you know, find elect Amy McGrath by a large margin.
And so, we also have an interesting thing happening in Georgia.
Yes.
Because both Senate seats are going to be up in Georgia.
Right.
Johnny Isaacson is retiring.
Right. And David Perdue was already going to retire. Right.
Was up anyway.
Yeah, was up. Because
I think he's running, right?
He's running.
But so there's one open seat and one incumbent seat.
Right. And they will both be up in 2020 because the governor, Matt Kemp, gets to appoint someone for Johnny Isaacson's seat because he's actually retiring before.
Right. He's retiring, I think, right away. Basically.
And so there will be an incumbent.
But it won't be a meaningful appointee.
He'll basically have to start running the race immediately.
It's basically
an open seat, even though there will technically be an incumbent.
It's one of those seats where you get to appoint someone until the next election.
Right. But, which will be in 2020. And we're
so
close to that.
You know, people are. We all have our eye on Stacey Abrams. I don't know what's going
to
happen.
I know.
With that.
And now that there's I'm wondering if she's going to be able to escape that. I mean,
She didn't want to. It's clear she doesn't want to represent it.
Right.
But I also personally want her to.
I was going
to
say.
So.
And that's the type of thing where if we can get two good candidates there, even if you only win one of those, I would think that both of them are probably going to be in the toss-up category. But if you can get one of those, that's a pickup.
Exactly.
You know, because they're both Republican.
Right, and we only need
to
flip four seats,
you guys. They're both Republican held.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we just listed, you know, if you include the two Georgia seats, that's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
Mean, so some of them are probably a little bit more far-fetched than the others.
Yeah, but we only need half,
right.
So whatever.
Yeah.
Get your thinking caps
exactly.
on.
Yeah, exactly.
And the only downside of this Georgia situation is that there's discussion that John Ossoff, radically boring John Ossoff,
that's right,
is thinking about running for one of the seats. Here's the thing about John Ossoff.
Yeah.
Don't run for office if you're John Ossoff.
He was, if you remember, he ran in that special election, and he had all of
Earth's money. Yeah.
I mean, literally every single Democrat.
And Earth's attention.
Every single Democrat who lived in this country gave him at least a dollar.
That's right.
I mean, I think it was the most expensive House race that had ever happened because it was like one of the first ones that they saw as winnable.
It was the first post-Trump
post-Trump, and he got his ass handed to him.
Yeah.
And he should go away.
And the reason he got his ass handed to him is because we, as people who carefully followed that race, who carefully follow every race, could not point to a single identifying feature about his platform or his person.
Right. Correct.
He's a human being.
Yes.
He has dark hair.
Right.
He looks like Joel Osteen a little bit.
A little bit.
Mm-hmm. And that's all I know about him, other than that New York Magazine called him radically boring.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's not, and that got reprinted, I believe, by a local paper too.
Right, yeah.
Because we initially saw that in a local news story about it.
Yeah, we were like, this is genius.
Yeah. And so you don't want to be called radically boring while you're running for office.
No, that's not
that's the kind of radicalism that you're not really looking for.
Yeah. The radicalism that you are looking for.
Yes.
Is canceling medical debt.
That's right. In what I think is only happening because there are multiple progressives in the race, so they're having to one-up each other.
Amazing.
Bernie Sanders just came up with a plan that he proposed yesterday on Saturday to cancel $81 billion in existing past due medical debt.
Yeah. And you know what? When I saw that number, I thought to myself, that's not very much money.
I was just going
to
say, it's cheap.
Yeah.
It's cheap to cancel medical debt, it turns out.
Let's do that.
This, like, it's... This some of this stuff is so cheap.
That's an easy one.
A lot of the time, because the numbers sound big because you don't have $81 billion, you think to yourself, I don't know. Should we spend $81 billion on getting universal pre-K? And, you know, like, Liz Warren has a plan to raise $80 billion and then put it into schools, into universal education initiatives, stuff like that. And when you think about how little money that actually is compared to the trillions of dollars we spend on some nonsense foreign policy, on tax breaks for wealthy Americans. I mean, $80 billion is probably what Amazon should have paid us in taxes last year.
Totally. Yeah.
You know?
100%. No, I know. And, you know, as Reuters was quick to point out, I think in the very first sentence of this story, was that he offered no details on how it would be financed. But I don't give a shit.
Tax increases, you guys. Sorry about it.
Right. Yeah.
Raising the taxes on, especially on wealthy Americans.
Yeah. But he said in his statement, he said the government would negotiate and pay off past due medical bills that have been reported to credit agencies. The proposal, he said, would also repeal some elements of the 2005 bankruptcy reform bill and allow other existing and future medical debt to be discharged. Now, there's a few things there. Because one thing that I learned recently, and I learned this as I was going through the process of buying a home, is that medical bills are ones that you often don't know are dinging your credit history.
Yeah.
Because the medical billing process, as you know, if you've ever seen, it's convoluted. And like you often sort of, and I had one, actually. I had to jump through all kinds of hoops and ultimately never had it removed from my credit history. I paid it, and so it showed it was paid, but like it still showed as like a ding, basically, because like you go through this, you go through this whole process of like medical billing, and you get 100 different bills, and you get things that say that they're not bills, and you think
and
that you paid everything, and they
thing.
don't also notify you in the ways, and they also sort of like if you've moved, which I had actually, because this was about 3 years ago, which was at that time too. It basically just sort of like a bill that I literally did not know that I had, and was never sort of like at least what I felt appropriately notified was due.
Well, that happens all the time, especially because you often get billed months after.
Really screwed my FICO score. So it affects you in ways that you sort of like don't really necessarily see. Besides the fact like, you know, it's the leading cause of people going bankrupt.
Yeah, and has been for years.
Which was why he, you know, wants to, as part of this bill, repeal some of the 2005 bankruptcy.
And I want to point out one more thing before we move on, which is Brent has employer-sponsored health insurance. He is not, Brent just described that whole story to you as a person who's been employed by the same company since the dawn of time.
Right.
Like, I have these problems constantly.
Yeah.
I've also been on 4 different insurances in the last 4 years.
Sure.
So this really gets complicated with me. I get bills from insurance companies where I can't find the card because it was 4 cards ago or whatever. Brent, though, is just describing to you how him, a person with a stable income and a stable job and stable benefits.
Who's not a person who is just, like, going around, like, having a bunch of delinquent payments. Like,
exactly.
That are,
who
like,
pays
I,
his bills.
I had otherwise good enough credit to buy a home.
Exactly.
So, like,
is a person who was not able to navigate the hospital billing system because he found out that he had an outlying bill that he had never been told about.
Right.
That's the world we live in.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, continue.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it.
I just feel like every day these presidential candidates are going on about how you can keep your employer-sponsored health insurance. They're not addressing how that doesn't solve the problem.
Right. My employer sponsored health insurance, besides being
bill.
Not great, also almost caused me to not be able to buy a house.
Anyway, moving on.
Anyway,
Brent remembered the most important detail in the history of people remembering random facts about things.
Right. As soon as I saw that he was into repealing some of the 2005 bankruptcy bill, I was like, wasn't that the bankruptcy bill that caused Elizabeth Warren to basically start her political career and also try and ruin Joe Biden?
And the answer is yes.
Yes, it is.
He had remembered that correctly.
Yes.
Back in 2005, there was this bankruptcy bill.
Yes.
It was passed by large majorities, but mostly Republicans.
He was one of the only Democrats
that voted
for it. Obama voted no for it.
Right.
I mean, like, you're Your Democratic heroes voted no for it.
That's right. Joe Biden voted yes.
Right.
And was considered one of the lead Democratic voices for it.
Right, because it basically, it made it harder for individuals to file for bankruptcy and then therefore get out of debt. And it was like, also had like some legal changes to the credit card companies and like retailers.
It was in favor of making it difficult for people to discharge debt. And it was done at the behest of credit card companies.
Exactly. They were behind
and major lenders. So yes. And like we said, it was passed with large majorities, but by Republicans.
Right. But she literally came for him because she testified on that bill because she was at the time she was still a Harvard bankruptcy lawyer. And then it was like one of the things that like inspired her to like become a senator, to like run for Senate, was just how bad that bankruptcy bill was.
Not only her area of expertise because she literally testified before Congress about it, but also the reason that Liz Warren, as we know her.
Right.
Became exists. Liz Warren as we know
her. Like, I think Joe Biden has in the past said, like, that she's given him a hard time before.
Yeah.
It was about that bankruptcy.
That's right.
So I am curious to see how that play. Like, obviously, like, I think that Sanders, like, means what he says when he wants to cancel this debt. But I'm interested to see if this is going to come as sort of a more coordinated attack.
Well, that's what I'm Biden. So excited
about it.
It's
interesting that it comes very, you know, before this next debate here. Mm-hmm. I'll be curious to see where Warren comes out on this herself.
I have been saying that I want to see them double team the field, and they finally are going to get a chance at the next race.
Yeah.
And I mean, at the next debate, and for him to release a plan that gives her an opening to talk about her actual area of academic expertise this way is so genius. Because what do they have to fight about?
No, nothing.
They can just sit around and be two people who have the same ideas, basically.
Right, and we talked about this after the last debate, where people were sort of like, you know, when are they going to come for each other? And it's like, it shouldn't be this debate.
No, I don't think it should be ever. Like, I think at some point...
The two of them, they're on either side of him.
Exactly.
I mean, ruin him.
It's so perfect. I mean... It's so perfect. But yeah, so this feels like if it's not a coordinated attack, it is certainly something that will lend itself... It's a strategic move for him... Because it gets him some buzzy attention.
Right.
But it also gives an opening for him to get some support from the other side of the stage to really lead into a discussion. And this is actually, these are the kinds of things that I think because, you know, one of the things that Liz Warren is really good at doing is making complicated financial policy seem simple.
Yeah.
And these are the kinds of laws that for years people like Joe Biden have been sort of quietly voting 100%. On. It's like, you know, it's like repealing Glass-Steagall. It's like those kinds of policies... have sort of plagued the Democratic Party because their own leadership has been voting conservative economic policy into place for years.
Yep.
And to have no one anywhere who can describe what happened makes it very difficult for voters to wrap their mind around what this means. And this is the perfect opportunity because, you know, Sanders is going to go in there and he's going to go in there with talking points because he's like the activist.
Right.
And then Warren is going to get to go in there and explain to everyone what he's talking about.
Well, right. And that's the thing, too, because I think... Who wants to hear about bankruptcy policy?
Nobody.
You know, but like I think
except for a country of people who are going bankrupt due to this exact issue.
Right, but at least the minutia of it anyway.
Yeah,
but she can explain that in a way where it doesn't sound like you're getting into the minutia of a bankruptcy bill.
Exactly. It's going to be perfect.
Yeah.
I'm very excited. So
yeah.
In any case, so we're going to head to our interview with Kip. We recorded it a little bit earlier today.
Yeah.
And then we'll be back to say goodbye at the end. But really do listen. This was a really exciting interview. I think it was really informative. And we're going to hopefully have him back on a few months down the road to talk about how his campaign is going. Because we were really excited to hear sort of like what it is to start a campaign, what you do, what phone call you make.
Yeah, but I think you'll get
the idea. So I think you'll enjoy it. And now we have Kip Mueller here, who is running for a state Senate seat in California, just a little north of where we live here. And it's a seat that's currently held by Republicans in Santa Clarita and environs, not just Santa Clarita, as we have just discussed. Mm-hmm. But we thought we would talk a little bit about what it is to start up a campaign, what kinds of considerations go into not only choosing a place to run, but also figuring out what they need, staffing up, and how to build a campaign infrastructure and things like that. So welcome, Kip, to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, welcome.
So I think the first thing we wanted to ask you is really why this district? What about this district? I know we've spoken about it personally a bit, and I know you've told me that it was one of the most winnable seats for Democrats in the state. But why specifically did you decide to jump in?
So I'd been spending time in the district personally, professionally, and politically. I actually So supporting Katie's campaign, I have a PAC that brought money and support for her campaign and was personally spending a lot of time there bringing volunteers to the district. And in the meantime, I was meeting people and meeting the community and learning what they want from their representatives and learning that the current representation was not representing the interests of the community and that there was this organic activism growing in this community like I'd never seen before.
Well, especially because they had a really contested congressional race. And yes. Katie was Katie Hill, by the way, that one of our big 2018 victories in this area.
Yes.
And so it sounds like there was a lot of excitement, I remember, up there, a couple years ago.
District that has been held by a Republican, at least in Congress for a long time.
For a long time at the state level, at the local levels, has been historically Republican. But there's been people laying the groundwork for decades that has grown into, it's just been this organic growth and it's been proliferated very fast in a profound way. And it was contagious. And I was really excited every time I was up there to meet more people and see it grow and wanted to be a part of it. At the same time, I'm an asylum attorney and I do pro bono asylum cases. So I go to Adelanto Detention Center and represent asylum seekers, and that's also up in the district, so I was spending time doing that. And then I have clients as a workers' rights attorney who are in the district, including I represent the family of a guy, a union laborer, who died on the job, and so I'm spending time up there for that. And so a lot of my life was up in this area, and it just felt like a very natural progression to join the district and be a part of the fight. I initially intended to support whoever was going to have a viable campaign this seat. Sure. It's true.
Yeah.
So,
we've
never said that to ourselves, I feel like. That's not our strategy. It's a more admirable approach than ours, which is to complain a lot.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah.
So was exploring to see who could win this and talking to leaders in the community and eventually realized that I might have a shot at creating a campaign and doing this. And sought encouragement and got it from some people, and it took off from there.
Yeah, and is this the first time that you've run
for office? This is the first time I've run for office. I was in the Student Senate.
Yeah.
sure. Uh-huh. Student government.
So that was big. But this is my first real run, and it's been really fun. It's been really, really fun.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure in this cycle, too, where we just had, like, such an exciting midterms, and it's a presidential cycle, so there's just, like, a lot of interest in the elections that are going on, especially, like, in a state like this where we often don't get exciting contested elections.
Yeah.
These local-level elections are really all we have.
Yeah.
Because at the presidential level, we get largely ignored for most of the cycle, so it's probably an exciting time to be in one of those districts that
totally
has, you know, seats that get actually contested.
And the good news is, with the primary being moved to March, now we are getting more attention for presidential as well.
We got to go to a presidential event after we went to Iowa.
I know.
We came back to LA just in time to catch Liz Warren here.
Right, awesome. Not in Iowa.
But it was exciting.
We saw Seth Moulton days before he dropped out when we were
That's true. We're some of the last people to ever have seen Seth Moulton.
That's right.
So you decide to run for office.
Yeah.
You're sitting in your office or your house or whatever. What is your first phone call? Like, what do you do when you're like, all right, I'm going to do it. Who do you call?
It was gradual. It was less, I can't even actually remember the moment that I said I was at this, like, I'm 85% sure.
Well, I remember you being 85% sure for a long time.
Yeah. But I was checking in with folks, other community leaders, and I really wanted to make sure that, it made sense.
Yeah.
And that
sure.
the community would support my campaign. And so I was doing my due diligence and checking in with as many people as I could. And so I was pretty sure for a really long time, and I was still also trying to figure out whether there was someone else who could put up a great campaign and win this.
Yeah.
So anyways, I think I did decide. I think my mom was my first call, I think. Yeah.
Sure.
You got to call your mom.
Yeah. And it was, she was supportive, but also like, really?
What are you doing?
It was some of both. And
you should have called my mom. She would have been super excited.
I should have. I'm sorry, Mom. No, my mom was, she was supportive. But also, but like, it's a big move for sure. And then talking to, confirming with people in the community and family. Family and friends.
Yeah.
But everybody was really receptive to it. People are excited about younger people getting involved in running.
Yeah.
And just doing it. Just yeah. get.
Well,
just
that
go.
Was kind of the excitement of the Katie Hill campaign
yeah.
too. She
yeah,
was
for sure.
a millennial. She,
right.
you know, that
and
was
total and like was really running as one.
Yes.
I mean, like it was
right.
It
wasn't pretending
wasn't,
to be
right.
an elderly person
right.
who just had great skin
right.
running for office.
No, she was like, I'm a millennial, and that's like part of. Who I am
yeah.
in Canada.
And it resonates with people. They see that on all, a lot of these issues, if we're talking about climate change, if we're talking about what does the 21st century working class look like? Is it a comfortable
yeah.
enough life? People understand that those questions are ones that our generation deserves a voice in because we're at a pivotal point on those issues
yeah.
right now.
Right.
And we're big.
And we're, yeah.
We're
right.
a big
yeah,
generation.
A true. Yeah.
And determined.
Well, yeah.
yeah.
Well, when you're a big generation, you also stand to have, you have a lot more to lose because programs become expensive for big generations. And so that's when you
sure.
start being like, you yeah. start hearing people being like, spending
yeah.
is too high and nothing can happen and
yeah.
we can never do, you know, big generations lose out a lot more. I think the 60s generation was also a large generation and that's
yeah.
part of why they kind of galvanized the way they did.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so we're kind of in that.
And I think we're just frustrated. It's like so many times the issue of climate change comes up and politicians fall short.
Yeah.
And we're just like, this is not fair. When somebody
yeah.
who's older, who has, like, we have so much of a stake in the decisions
right.
made right now on that issue.
Yeah.
We
totally.
Deserve a voice and a powerful voice on that issue.
Yeah.
And it's so exciting to see young people and mostly women and young people just, like, leading
yeah.
the charge and,
yeah.
and taking back these seats for ourselves so that we get to have a say.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you were going to support any sort of viable candidate there before you decided to run. There's obviously the incumbent, but there is another Democratic candidate running, and we're in a jungle primary system. So sort of talk about that. You know, just
right. Yeah, what is it to run in a
running,
jungle primary
running
system?
Running against everyone, basically,
right.
is what
yeah.
you're doing right now.
Yeah, it's fun, and it's I'm very much of the approach of I even actually told my opponent in this race, I'm playing golf and I'm just playing the course and I'm
just
giving my
doing the
pitch yep,
right.
to the community.
Yeah.
And so this is what our campaign's about. This is what we're interested in. This
yeah.
is the policy that we want.
Yeah.
And on issues where I may differ from others in the primary, we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
But it's respectful and I'm not focused really at all on my primary opponents. I'm really just focused
yeah.
on delivering our message and making sure that we have the wherewithal to have a successful campaign in the general election as well.
Yeah.
So there may be more people that hop in the primary. I don't know.
Yeah. When do you have to file by in that district?
I don't know the
race.
Filing deadline for the primary. I mean, the primary is obviously March 3rd. I think maybe it might be the end of the year. I don't know, but. I haven't heard of it. Maybe somebody joins. That's cool, and we'll have a conversation with that
well,
person as well.
Probably someone
know?
Has
and
who
so.
No one's ever heard of. I feel like one of the mysteries of jungle primaries is that up to 12,000 people can join
yeah.
who you've never heard of.
Right.
Who
right.
you're not sure where they got the signatures or what. You know, like whether they're real people.
Yeah.
Totally.
Whether they've spelled their own name correctly
yeah.
on the. I mean, there's a lot of mysterious things that
yeah.
happen
yeah.
in the jungle
yeah.
primary system.
Yeah.
So to
and
some
it's
degree,
fun.
It's like getting out of that muck to
yes.
even be like one of the people who's like a legitimate
yeah.
candidate in the race.
But to me, it's like really not, I swear it's not muck to me. It's like,
well,
I you know, the conversation,
yeah.
I like the conversation. I like
sure.
I like having it and I like
when I assume
other,
also you're
you
not
know.
In a seat where like 34 people are going to run. Like it's
yeah.
not like our Senate seat or something
no.
where there is muck because there's
the
like, right, there's
right.
like 25
right.
people who are like not people anyone's ever heard of who
totally.
Are running,
yeah.
you know, and you have to find your candidate on a list of 16
yes, you're
people.
Right. And that,
right.
No, it probably won't be. It won't be like that.
Does
so,
running in that kind of system give you a chance to engage with the Republican incumbent in a way that you think maybe wouldn't be the case if you had to run like a traditional primary first and then, you know, get into the general?
You would think. I don't think that's really going to happen. I
no.
think we're really just going to be talking on the Democratic side. I don't think that.
Are you basically
Scott
vying for the second spot, and he's sort of guaranteed a.
Maybe
as the
mean,
incumbent. I mean,
I hope to get over 50% of the
right.
vote in the primary. I'm going to fight to do it. But if that happens, I mean, I'm just not so sure how much he'll be directly engaged with the rest of the primary. I have no idea. Maybe he will. I have no idea. But
yeah.
But right now the conversation is between Democrats for the time being, and it's really about fundraising and
yeah.
and delivering the right message
yeah.
for this community.
How much time do you feel like you have to be doing that?
More than I am probably. It's so much because it's always more than what you're doing.
Right.
Like
yeah.
you can't possibly do enough, and it's because running for office is extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you spend a lot of your time asking people for money, which is fine, you know. And it's just it's what you do. You have to do it. It's
sure.
just part of the process. But the nice thing about it is in that in that process, you're also getting your message out there of what you're interested in accomplishing.
That's
and
true.
You're having
right.
real conversations right. with people, many of whom want to be wooed, or at least they want to hear, well, okay, if I'm going to give you money, you got to tell me why. What are you
right.
doing?
Right.
And so
that's just sort of hones your message, I
yeah,
guess,
exactly.
to a degree, probably, right?
And, yeah. And you get to have more conversations with more people about what you're interested in and hear their voices and their concerns. So it's not the worst thing, but it's a lot of, it's a lot of your day is asking for money.
Do you, do you have to have people, are there people that consult in this district on those kind of considerations? Like, I know this is a district that hadn't had a lot of meaningful, you know, races in a long time. Obviously, with Katie Hill's race, there's probably sort of a store of experts with knowledge of the district that didn't exist before or were at least not sort of finding work out there
so
doing that.
One of the things, although there's been a lot of recent success, I continuously like to point out to people that I've met a lot of people in this community who have been doing the work for some time.
Right. Well, there's always the community work
totally.
To do.
And they know the district very well.
Yeah.
And have been doing great stuff. And they brought us to this precipice where now
right.
we're able to actually accomplish and win these elections. And there's a wealth of knowledge in this district about what people are interested in, what they want to see.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm also just having direct conversations with voters, but I speak to community leaders and they know what this district wants. So
are there specific issues to the district? I mean, I'm sure there are, but would there be any that might be surprising or
people it's funny because I keep hearing this, it's stated in the presidential debates a lot, and it's absolutely true that ultimately people just want a comfortable life that's livable, right? And if you work full-time, you should be able to live a comfortable life, and that's what people want. And I grew up, my dad was a house painter, my mom was a community college counselor, and we grew up, you know, modestly a working family, but the first of the month was okay. Like, we weren't scared of the first
right.
of the month the way that millions of families are now. There's a lot of families in my district that the first of the month is tough. And I feel that. And so the primary focuses of my campaign are making sure that we have robust jobs in our district because we have tremendous opportunity. We've got a big aerospace industry and a lot of engineers in the district. And,
oh, interesting.
There's a lot of wind and a lot of sun and a lot of companies that are interested, clean energy companies. If they have the right people to back them in political leadership, to coming into the community and getting all kinds of jobs. High level, low level, whatever, all types of wage jobs, but comfortable jobs. So that reducing costs of healthcare. I mean, it's
sure.
things that you hear talked about a lot because everybody's dealing with it, you know, and better quality
right.
healthcare.
Yeah.
And infrastructure, like the roads need desperate help, and there's not enough money coming from Sacramento into this
sure.
district.
Yeah.
So stuff like that.
Yeah.
The usual. Do you see?
Yeah.
You spoke a little bit about being a sort of, as a younger voice, having sort of specific concern for environmental issues and what our future would look
definitely.
Like there, but do you see like opportunity for that to, you know, for green industries to come into your district
yeah.
or things like that? Like, is that part of your sort of?
It's both. Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Plan for the district.
Definitely. Definitely. And it's two birds, one stone, which is great. There's so much, and people want these clean energy jobs there. But the fact is, whether we like it or not, we are transitioning towards clean energy, and we're in a race to the top with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And California's leading that race. And over the next 10, 20, 30 years, we're in the nascent stages of building out the clean energy economy. Where are all those jobs going to be? California already employs 5 times more people in clean energy than in fossil fuels. And it continues to grow, that gap. And our district, unfortunately, just isn't... Because of current leadership, we're just not caught up with that, and we're not winning
right.
this race.
You're not sort of benefiting from that change as much
be.
As other districts.
Absolutely. And we have to do it in a careful way. There's a lot of people that are currently employed by the fossil fuel industry, and we have to make sure that those people have direct lines to new jobs if they are moving towards a clean energy economy.
Yeah.
So we need to do it in a responsible way, but we need to do it in an efficient way and move towards clean energy in a bold way, because we don't have a choice and we don't get to debate with the science. You guys already know the science.
Right.
Preaching to the choir here, but We don't get to have
tell
the,
me about how climate change is real.
How it's a problem. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I'm here to tell you guys about this. Yeah.
We'd love to know more about it.
So I want it. Yes, I definitely want to see it. And it's a tremendous opportunity for this district. These jobs are great jobs. And that's one of my primary goals. If I'm state senator, I'm going to push to get money into Sacramento. From Sacramento into our district. Yeah. And I'm also going to push for getting these companies, who I have friends from school who are at these companies, and getting them to invest in our community.
Oh, yeah. Here's a question, which I feel like is a sort of broader question, but might be, I think, interesting to our listeners, because we talk a lot about national level political races, federal office, and we talk a little bit about California. And we've spoken to, you know, we've had the mayor of West Hollywood on here, so we've done like sort of micro level, or talked about sort of micro level politics. But what does the state do that is, you know, as opposed to, you know, when you go and elect your, you know, congressperson, you have a sense of what the federal government is up to because it's in the major papers every day.
Totally.
The state government here has a reputation for being corrupt. Mm. It has Democratic supermajorities everywhere, but doesn't seem to be able to take advantage of that a lot of the time because there's a lot of like drama always going on in Sacramento.
Sure.
But so what is our state legislature empowered to do? What are the kinds of things that state government does for people? Because I think more people would run for these seats if they had a sense of what their state government does.
Yeah.
And especially in a state like California, where the state government is running essentially a country, because California is huge and has a huge economy. And so they really have a lot of responsibility that's meaningful.
Totally.
And meaningful, you know, in just sort of in terms of setting agendas in other states even.
Yep.
So what does a state senator do?
Oh, man, I have so many answers to that question.
Perfect.
Okay, so that's okay. It's a great question. So one thing I want, just the baseline, so the way our government operates, the federal government is a limited government by the Constitution, right?
Right.
So any powers that the federal government is not supposed to have, those go to the states, and the states have the default power to regulate any and all things they want, or to have power over any and all things that aren't federally preempted, which is a lot of stuff. So the states do a lot of stuff. The cool thing about being in California especially is what you alluded to. As an example, there was four major car companies that came to Sacramento and negotiated a deal to get their miles per gallon up on their cars, because when California passes regulations on miles per gallon, it's such a big state that these car companies just have to change all of their cars.
Right.
Yeah.
And
right.
Donald Trump hates that. And
right.
I think it's great.
Yeah.
And so we have immense power to, and not even just like that direct form of controlling sort of issues like environmental issues like that, but also even when we take a stance on a given issue, it reverberates across the rest of the country.
Yeah.
If we stand up in some form of resistance, and our attorney general's done it at the state level here, then other attorney generals take up the fight against Trump. So we set the tone, and we get to be the home of the resistance to this administration, which is really exciting. In terms of like the raw powers that are in the state, I mean, so I'm a labor attorney, and the entire California labor code I have to I operate with is controlled by the state, and I'm interested in seeing some changes to that that will be positive for workers. Obviously the things that make our everyday, you know, the power and the water that are part of our lives each and every day are controlled, and that's an immense important power of the states. Where do you?
There's a lot of funding that comes in. The reason that this would be meaningful to your district if you get elected is that a lot of the funding that comes into your district for things that are like real everyday things in your life are controlled by state government and local government.
Yep.
They're not controlled by federal government. Things
like,
you know, like roads,
a lot of
road maintenance that isn't like the interstate highway system.
And our roads are a problem. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, our roads are
they
a big
certainly,
problem.
California has a has a checkered history with road quality that some, for a state that loves driving and killed all of their trolleys, really.
That's right. Absolutely.
You know?
And the high speed rail is another issue that we're trying, and getting more public transportation and better public transportation. So
just any public transportation.
Any public transportation, totally.
In certain areas.
Yeah.
Yes. And a lot of our community commutes to Los Angeles, And
oh yeah, that I was going to ask you about
so
that.
Congested.
Because that it's I know Santa Clarita is a bit of a commuter community, but I assume that the rest of that district also has a lot of commuting.
It's a good amount. So a lot of people do work in districts, like in their own cities and communities as well. But there's a fair amount of people that do the commute, and it's just it's a tough long commute.
Well, there's a certain amount of reverse commuting that goes on to Santa Clarita too, where there's because there's like studios up there. There's a lot like there's an entertainment infrastructure in Santa Clarita. So a lot of a lot of writers' rooms like. Even work out there. Right. People shoot out there.
Exactly.
I know because I've had to do that drive many times.
Oh, yeah.
Eras where I didn't necessarily want to have to face said traffic.
So like the traffic's and up and down the 5, the 14 is our highway that goes across horizontally,
right,
and then vertically. But it also gets very congested, and people want to see things like the roads. They want to see a CSU. Like a 4-year college in Lancaster or Palmdale. So many people that graduate high school, and there's good community colleges, but and there's good schools, but we need way more robust 4-year universities. Either
when especially in a state where things like housing is so expensive, so if you don't have a local 4-year college that is commutable, then a lot of people sort of get left out of that opportunity, even if they're able to go get an associate's degree or something at a community college. You need somewhere to go.
Totally. After that. And like you develop relationships with the local 4-year university.
Yeah.
When so your high school is like, here's how you get to go to CSU.
Totally.
Palmdale. Here's how you get to go to CSU. Victorville. And so having a school like that and having students grow up where they see this school and that's where they want to be is a wonderful thing. And then also having more trade schools. I mean, if we can get some, if we can get some clean energy jobs into this district, we should also be training people to do those jobs,
right?
Training them in engineering or whatever other you know skills are needed, and building an economy out that way. And there's again so much opportunity for that. So, but anyways, going back to your question, it's education, it's labor, it's I mean, you name it, pretty much anything you care about. If you're listening to this, the state has some role, if not the most prominent role, in making sure that that issue is handled properly. So.
Yeah, and that's I think truly not well understood.
Yeah.
Because it's not glamorous. It doesn't have the same glamour associated with it that you know, like it doesn't make you famous to be you know, in the state senate.
Sure.
But all these issues we're talking about at the federal level, as an example, police brutality issues and things like law enforcement and it's you know, how to properly handle that issue.
Yeah.
That's states.
State.
Yeah.
Or if it's mass incarceration, similarly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's true that when it should be addressed at the federal level, no doubt, and we should be talking about it nationally, mass incarceration, for example. But if you're not handling it at the state level, you're just not dealing with the problem.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
have to deal with it at the state level. And that's true for a lot of these issues that are talked about. And because there's not a lot of room for nuance when you're running for president, a lot of times people kind of brush that over and just say, I want to fix mass incarceration.
Right. I will change this if you vote for me.
Yeah. And, you know, they have both direct and indirect power to do it. They can influence the narrative in the country and move states to do things.
State legislatures will pick up their phone calls, too.
Sure.
You know?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
If I could get more people to pick up my phone calls, I feel like things would be different in this country.
Yeah. Absolutely. So it's so anyways, but like you can't handle a lot of these issues without talking about how we're going to make effectuate the change at the state level. And and actually what's cool is Democrats are becoming more aware of this, I think, for sure.
Oh, I think it's that's much become much
Republicans have known it for a while.
Republicans have been sort of sneakily sort of taking up taking state houses,
school
taking
boards.
Legislature, school boards, things like that. I know like I've been following the sort of resurgence of this focus in New York City really carefully because I'm you know, involved in an issue that is very much grounded in New York City. And so I've been noticing that happening there. And it's harder to see here because we're so much more spread out that a lot, you know, like I would say a lot of the Katie Hill race was exciting, but it was also the closest real contested race that we had to focus on. But when it comes to state level politics, you really don't here down in West Hollywood.
I think
like,
it's easy to get into like a funk here. And
it's
sort of
right
like,
to feel like there's nothing, you know, if there's not like an exciting race that you've heard of going on, that like there's nothing happening around here because it's harder to, it doesn't feel as coordinated as it does in a place where everyone's like up in each other's business more. There are exciting things happening in, and certainly like I know Orange County has a lot of exciting things happening as well. So it's not just sort of north of the city, but it seems like in the ring around LA, there's actually kind of been like a resurgence of local level focus that,
most definitely.
That I think an effective Democratic Party should be running people in as many places as possible.
Yes. Yeah.
And we really haven't, as a national strategy, have not been doing that for a long time, it seems like. Anyway, yeah.
And I think we're finally starting. Yeah. You can feel it happening now, and it's too bad that it took this president to get us there, but maybe now we're finally getting there.
Right.
So one other issue I just wanted to mention, homelessness. Like, we all talk about it constantly. Yeah. The state is, it's properly handled at the state level. I mean, we need assistance from federal, but it's mostly state.
Well, and I think they just recently, didn't they agree to not anything to do with homelessness, but I guess it's a cause of it anyway. But there's a new housing bill, I think.
There is a new housing bill. It caps the maximum amount of rent increase over the next 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. And so they're taking steps to make sure that people don't continue. That's one of the things that's so hard about this is we're trying to drain the sink, but it's still leaking as we're trying to drain it. What's the analogy? It's like, so the problem is people just continue to, there's another person who has an unexpected medical bill who now can't pay their rent. And so we have to deal with it on both ends. But homelessness is one of those issues. Like, it's because of our general neglect, our disinterest at state and local politics, that something like this happens.
Yeah.
We're at a breaking point and thinking, gosh, this is... Well,
because these are man-made crises. I mean, these are not crises that we needed to have.
No.
Housing is never a crisis you need to have. Right. A healthcare crisis is never a crisis you need to have. These are crises created by policy.
Yes, absolutely.
And they're all crises of inequality, ultimately. Like, that's kind of what they're rooted in.
Yeah.
So they're all rooted in the same problem.
Totally.
Which is just sort of like, I don't know. It's not even a laissez-faire attitude towards people's welfare. It's more of a just like aggressive Darwinism attitude towards people's welfare, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And it's now reached a point. And the good news is I think people are realizing that they thought that if it was Darwinism that led them before, they're realizing that this is bad for everyone to have people without homes. We have the resurgence of tuberculosis and typhus taking place on our streets.
Right.
And it's inexcusable. And it clearly falls on the shoulders of politicians. I mean, there's no one else to blame.
Well, and it's solvable because we have actually sort of solved these problems before. I mean, tuberculosis was a problem in New York City when I was growing up. If you worked, my mother was a social worker for a long time, or not a long time, a brief time, but she used to say, like, at that time it was not uncommon that people who worked in social work would get test positive for tuberculosis because you were just exposed to it everywhere. You were exposed on the subway or whatever. And, like, we did resolve that for a while. It doesn't seem like it has to be that.
Totally.
You know?
Totally. And it's so funny. Even, I mean, the vaccines are actually, and like the anti-vaccine movement is like a perfect analogy for all this. We solve the problem, then we find a way to create the problem.
Right, to recreate the problem again.
How do we make this more problematic for ourselves?
Things have gotten too easy over here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Always too easy.
Yeah, so one thing that New York actually has is a right to housing, and it's something that I'm interested in. There's right now Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg and LA Supervisor Ridley Thomas, they're working right now on how to develop that here.
Yeah.
I want to see that, and that's one of the primary issues that I'm pushing during my campaign is a path to a right to housing at the very least. Where people are guaranteed housing. Because this is not
not a sustainable situation.
It's awful.
It's awful, and it's awful for everyone. It's awful for everyone. Especially awful if you're homeless. But
it shouldn't be an issue that has anything to do with party either.
No, it shouldn't at all. There was like, who can excuse this? I just heard this story. It's really sad. There's a girl who was 13 who was interviewed, and she's homeless, and they asked her about how she got addicted to meth, and her answer to that was, well, I was sleeping on the streets and I was afraid to go to sleep because I felt like I would be assaulted. Somebody told me an easy way to avoid being assaulted is to use meth.
Oh, perfect.
Now, this is in the wealthiest country the world has ever known, and we have these kinds of problems on our streets right in front of us. There's no excuse for it.
Yeah. Well, and even encroaching into even wealthy areas of the wealthiest country on earth, because I think that's one of the mysterious things about, I think, the housing crisis in LA in particular has been to me that visual evidence of it exists even if you live in Beverly Hills.
Yep.
Like, there is nowhere that you can go where you do not
You don't have to go to Skid Row.
No, and it used to be that part of the issue in LA was that it's so spread out, and the housing crisis that we have always had here
was
very contained.
It's
because
not hard to see.
It's not hard to see. It's like you just have to drive under an underpass. It's a city with no public transit, so you're driving under underpasses constantly. So, you know, like, it's, you know, you just have to be, if there is like one fence that doesn't seem to have anything behind it, there is like a camp in front of it, you know, like that is a change that has happened
that is
visual, that it's, you know.
Yeah, and oddly enough, it's odd to say, but I think it's good that it's in everyone's faces because we need to confront it. Yeah. And
well, and it's long been a crisis here. We've already had an enormous homeless population for decades in this city that we've never really resolved or dealt with in a meaningful way.
And I feel like one day we will solve this, and then kids will look back and they'll ask, they'll hear about how it was and just be like, how could you have lived?
Right, how would you live this way? Who would live this way?
Yes, dying on the streets, and we don't have an excuse.
Yeah.
So we got to fix it. Yep. Yeah. Anyway.
Right. Yeah. Do you have anything else that you would like to add?
Sure. Well, my team would kill me if I didn't mention kipforsenate.com.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Right.
Please check it out. And if you feel so compelled to contribute, please do so. So far it's been great. I appreciate your guys' time and I've really enjoyed this.
Oh yeah, anytime. If you want to come back at some point to let us know how it's going.
Give you a little update on what's going on.
I mean, one thing that's exciting about this is just, I think, getting to hear about what it is to run for office as like a person.
I should talk a little,
you know, is I think interesting to our listeners. We talk all the time about ridiculous electoral policy, you know, sort of fun story scandals, what, you know, who's running for what in what, you know, hilarious manner. But we really, like, ultimately, like, we are activists. We want people to take advantage of opportunities like the ability to run for office or even to get involved in campaigns. We want to make sure that people feel empowered to do that and understand how to do it. So for us, like,
it's first, I would say, if anybody's listening to this and you're considering running, I'd be happy to actually talk to you about it because you should do it. And it's really, I think we just need to be more willing to just dive in and take a chance.
Yeah.
I'm not an anointed one. I didn't grow up with, you know, family that was
your
super
father
connected.
Wasn't exactly. the head of the state senate, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I didn't have any of that, and I just started getting involved and caring and talking to people. And at some point, there's a leap of faith inevitably involved. I could, who knows? I could lose, you know, horribly. I have no idea what's going
to
happen.
Right, but it's valuable, I think, to have participated in a discussion. You know, even if you don't win, then you brought a discussion to the district that it wasn't having.
Yeah.
And if you don't win, you also learn how to run for office so that you can run a second time if you lose once.
Yeah,
you
know? And by the way, I intend to win.
Right,
and
we're putting together, of course.
Yes.
I just want to...
Uh-huh. Right.
And we're putting together a great campaign. But just to say to people, regardless of... You might live in a very red district where it feels like...
Right, that's my...
Know, yeah, totally.
That's so, my point.
You know, and polling just looks so bad for you and... Take a chance and meet people and
start the discussion. It builds an infrastructure where someone
then
people are familiar with the ideas and then someone can actually campaign to them on them.
And so it's not lost on me that the reason I have a good chance at winning this thing is on the shoulders of others. Katie Hill's one example. Christy Smith is a great assemblywoman in my district who won a tough fought campaign. And there's a number of other leaders in my community that have built the foundation. Without them, there'd be no chance for me to win. And likewise, wherever you are, even if you feel like this would be very hard to win, you move the needle, you get people more engaged, and you have a very net positive effect on the world. So I'm happy to talk with anybody who's thinking about doing it and and also to take advice from people too. Just have these conversations.
Right.
So I would encourage people to run. It's it's really, really fun. It's a wonderful experience together. So
cool. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah,
and definitely come back and let us know how it's going after a few months on the trail.
Cool. Yes. That sounds good. I will do that. Yeah.
Okay, awesome.
Thank you.
So that's it for this week.
Yep.
There were shootings and hurricanes this week as well.
Sure.
So, you know, things are going pretty much as usual here. Yeah. thoughts and prayers and hopefully some policy for the victims of Odessa.
Yes.
A new shooting.
I even heard, you know, Greg Abbott say something about the status quo in Texas is no longer working. I'm sure he'll probably figure out some way to solve it with having...
More guns.
More guns. But
good guys with guns on the streets.
Right, exactly. But at least, like, you know, I think that... They're trying to think of things.
That's right.
Anyway, they're at least...
He's
paying
lip service to the idea that you have to say more than thoughts and prayers these days.
Right.
They have
stopped thinking of ways to fix it.
That's right.
Because they didn't care.
That's right.
And now I think they're starting to think of
Texas
ways.
Well, Texas has been hit particularly hard.
But they're thinking.
That's right. That's a
start. That's a start.
That's the beginning.
Yeah.
And if you're in the path of Hurricane Dorian...
Get out.
Sorry about it. Get out of there.
Yeah, seriously.
Right. Sounds bad.
Yeah,
And we will be on break for a little bit, but we will keep you updated on social media about what we're up to. And we'll also be releasing our candidate profiles starting Monday.
Yeah.
Starting the day we release this podcast. Yeah. So definitely stay tuned for those. You'll learn a lot of interesting stuff about a lot of these candidates that you know nothing about and some of the ones you do.
Yeah.
So we'll see you. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.